Welcome to the Using the Whole Whale podcast, where we learn from leaders about new ideas and digital strategies making a difference in the social impact world. This podcast is a proud production of Whole Whale, a B Corp digital agency. Thank you for joining us. Now, let's go learn something.
Well, we have a guest today who has got a very interesting framework that I ran across, and he reached out to me and is part of the nonprofit.ist network of trusted consultants. And I was so curious that I was like, I have to have you on. I want to talk about, I don't want to give away too much, the seasons of change. But the guest, because I buried the lead, is Michael Randall, and he is the founder and director of Randall Consulting Associates. Randall, how's it going?
I'm good, thank you, George. How are you doing today?
I always love talking to new people, learning new things. And I think what you're bringing us is coming at a great time, because it's always a great time to be fundraising. But what I like is that you aren't running in with, here are three quick ways to raise money tomorrow. We're so much about the panic cycle of fundraising. I wonder if you can take us through your approach to the seasons of growth metaphor that you have.
Yeah. So I developed this as a very practical metaphor because I was working with more and more organizations that were growing. A number of my clients had received grants or gifts from Mackenzie Scott, and great opportunity. But what happens when you have lots of money or lots of growth plans? You know, there's The organization needs to also expand very often to be able to, you know, provide more services and new locations and with new audiences and things like that. I've been working with organizations, whether as a staff member or as a consultant, for about 35 years now. And so I've had a lot of experience in a lot of different places. And what I see time and again is that leaders and managers misunderstand what it's going to take to successfully grow the organization. They think that, oh, we can provide more services and then we'll catch up on staffing, or we'll quickly hire more people, but we'll wait a while before we go around to strengthening our systems or our processes. And so what I've been kind of begun to see and then practice in my work is actually thinking through what is actually going on and what do you need to be doing. And so what I kind of came to is the metaphor of a gardener, right? And as a gardener, while you might maybe own a piece of land, you know that you're really a steward of the land, that you're caring for it now, but at some point in time, you'll be passing it to somebody else. So what might you be doing to take care of this so that you're getting the best value from it today, but you're also making sure that you're not undermining its future potential? And so I then kind of developed three phases that I think happens in change processes and when you're growing and all the rest of it. And very simply, again, with this gardening metaphor. So the first part of this process of change is what we call preparing, right? You imagine that you're looking at your land and you see there's some rocks and weeds that you need to kind of move or get rid of. Cultivate the soil, bring in fertilizer, maybe bring in a water source. In a similar way with our growth processes, we need to kind of make sure that we kind of see what we've got to work with and what we need to change, what supplements we might need to be ready to really work on the garden. The middle phase, which typically takes the longest, is where we are actively caring for the garden. So this is the cultivating phase, right? We've planted things, we're nurturing them, we're helping them grow. We're taking out weeds that might come along the way. We're dealing with maybe a little invasion of some bug or a pest, and we respond. But we kind of take this thing through to fruition. And then the final phase, which I find actually often gets overlooked in many organizations, metaphorically we call it the harvesting phase. So you got the ripe fruit. You're able to sort of sit under the shade of a tree, really enjoy that place. But from a change process, it's really about how we consolidate all that we've been working on and integrate it into the ongoing work of the organization. And also how we acknowledge we've reached the end of a phase of growth and change, and we celebrate what we've accomplished. And then we look ahead to, so what's the next cycle going to be about? So I found this kind of metaphor very helpful. And when I work out with clients, they've also, you know, given the feedback, it's an insightful way of thinking about things. It helps them remember not just to kind of jump in feet first, but take the time to get ready, to prepare things, and then also to follow through.
It makes complete sense. And also, it's kind of funny because you start off with this moment of you'd expect in the story where, you know, Mackenzie Scott drops magic money on top of you. And I've heard amazing stories about folks being like, yeah, and then a check showed up, or I got a mysterious call, and then suddenly money. And it's not necessarily that you had a plan in place. So let's just be clear. This is a very exciting problem to have, but I'm still using the word problem because there's an expectation of growth. And I'm wondering, one of my concerns when a lot of money shows up is that you expand too quickly. So let's just play with the garden metaphor. I'm like, look at all this money. I'm going to buy up every single acre in the entire village, and I'm going to plant a whole bunch of seeds. Unfortunately, I now am in charge of the cultivation of a very, very large estate without maybe the staff to support beyond the range. I grow beyond my means and end up collapsing, sadly, sometimes worse than from where I began. Can you speak to this issue?
Yeah, you're describing something I've seen many times. I think part of it has to do with what we think of growth. What does growth mean? Right. And I think it often gets taken to mean expansion, more scaling. Right. And certainly that's part of it. But we could also think about growth as also having to do with quality, or maybe to do with getting more comprehensive. Right. So an organization that gets funding might not expand geographically. It might continue to work in the same community with the same people, but now it's able to bring in other additional valued services that previously were missing or absent. So I want to, you know, really encourage people to think holistically about growth. And it's not just about driving revenue, more money. It's not about being able to say that you were the leader of an organization with even more staff, but it's really thinking about the impact that you're trying to make, the difference you're trying to make, and not just that you can do it once, but that that change and difference can be sustained over time. And so again, I think that kind of gets you away from just what can we do to kind of, again, metaphorically in the gardening, kind of throwing in super fertilizer to make it bloom right now, but make sure that we're sort of tending to the underlying structures, to the soil quality, to the nutrition, to the water, to the sunlight, so that this place will actually grow appropriately and be able to support and sustain that growth on and into the future.
You hinted at it, saying you have seen this a number of times in the past where an organization expanded too quickly based on a short-term influx of capital. I don't know if you can give me a parable, you know, something of when the garden didn't grow quite so well.
Well, I play a lot with metaphors. So what it might look like is, you know, you suggested earlier that the farmer or the gardener buys a lot of land and plants lots of plants because they've got cash, right? What organizations do in the metaphor is that they don't lay in the piping for the watering system. So you've got still got one person running around with the watering can, and maybe that watering can has got a little bit of a leak because it's old, but now they've got a much larger area to support, but they've got the same tools. And so, of course, some of those nice, bright, green plants that you planted when you had lots of cash, they're going to start being under stress from lack of water, and eventually they'll die. Right? So investing in growth, thinking about what's the infrastructure, what are the support systems, what are the skills and capabilities we need to be able to support this long term is, okay, while we're expanding our reach, while we're bringing maybe in some bright, shiny new services to people, let's make sure we're also building in the pipeline infrastructure. Let's make sure that we're, you know, paying the water bills, so we're going to have continuing access to water. Maybe we need to hire a water technician to be able to maintain our system and keep it working well, right? So these are things that maybe you didn't need when you were a smaller organization, but they're things you're going to need as you grow and expand. So that's the kind of way we kind of encourage people to be thinking about these things. So what all is going on that's different from what we were doing before? And how do we need to expand our our mindset about what we're about and how we do things and you know, how do we go forward? I'll give you an example. I was talking to somebody recently who leads an organization that now has $100 million annual revenue. They're working in 60 countries, right? So they're doing some really impactful work, but their financial system is the financial system of a $10 million organization working in one country, right? It's scaled to be able to manage 100 million, but it doesn't have the efficiencies of a larger organization. So they have to do things like, you know, the way that they do expenses is still based on how they did it as a smaller organization. So things like that, you know, authorizations for expenditures also done in a way that was suitable when they were smaller, doesn't work now, but they haven't been able to bring about the change for a variety of reasons.
So in my experience, and I want your sort of outside take on, you know, let's garden metaphor the heck out of this thing, but the fastest road to ruin, and I've been at an organization that did this, that was coming out of this, and I have seen friends, I will say, at other organizations. The fastest road to ruin that I see when an influx of capital comes in is this idea that we need to expand. So we have the breadth versus depth conversation, and we need to do both, but sure, breadth. And what we need to do is national expansion. It sounds so good. I need to go national. And to go national, you know what I need, Michael? I need an office. Oh, I need some concrete on the ground. I need boots on the ground in the 10 major cities in the country. Now let's go out there and start spraying and praying with our money to put in these like foundational points, because that's the only way we can have an expanded impact. The next part of the story you can see coming is that they increase their overall expense budget beyond their revenue budget that doesn't catch up. They say they will catch up. And then unfortunately, you've got a mass contraction back from that. Like, that is a story that is so sadly common. And I wonder where Seasons of Growth might interrupt that story.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen that many times as well. I think one of the reasons why it fails is not just because the income doesn't catch up with the expenditures, but people haven't understood why were we successful in one place, right? So when we want to expand to 10 cities, we go out and we hire, let's just imagine, you know, 10 people in each office. So we're going to hire 100 people who know nothing about us as an organization. Maybe they work in the same field, but they don't know us as an organization. They don't know our culture. They don't know how we do the thing that we do. But now we've branded them as our people. But really, they're not our people. So I would argue that even if the revenue caught up and then you were able to afford those offices for several years, you don't have one national organization. You've actually got 10 distinct mini organizations who are going to struggle to be aligned, and they're going to struggle to replicate the impact and the success in those 10 new places because you haven't understood the importance of culture as a way of unifying and being a catalyst of sustaining change.
So you've mentioned sustaining change, which is actually another framework you have for the implementation. I wonder if we can use that, the sustained change framework that you've developed, to play a game. And this game is, let's help an executive, a leader who's looking at that national expansion moment. I want to, you know, roll out to the top 10 cities to do these things. How might we look at those five elements that you have in there? Which elements would you look at? How would you potentially architect that?
Yeah, so I would start with three things. And it doesn't quite matter necessarily in which order you begin, but they're interrelated with each other. So I've already spoken about culture, right? And so in this framework, because these are things that I see repeatedly in organizations, which is why these five elements are there, it's about an empowering culture. So it's about people having a similar way of working on things, having a way of working that's compatible, and a way that is promotes inclusion and belonging, right? So really that it's not just that we all wear the same t-shirt, that we look like we're the same, but we've actually really paid attention to all the different voices, all the different perspectives, and we're kind of making that part of our secret sauce. A second component has to do with effective teams, because I really believe that the successes we achieve and sustaining these successes is not because of the effort of individuals doing heroic work, but it's because of the collaborative work of groups and of teams of people. And so, again, we want to invest in helping our people to work together effectively in structured teams, being clear about their purpose, being clear about shared goals and accountability and things like that, having trust to be able to kind of work through difficult issues. And then the third thing I'm going to name as kind of a necessary, really important starting point has to do with capable people, right? Not just having enough people hired to fill all the slots, but there are people who have the right skills and the right experience. I had a client some years ago that actually doubled in size, both revenue and staffing, every year for 10 years. So they went from about a dozen people when this growth spurt started. When I came to work with them, there were about 300 people, right? Mm-hmm. And part of the joke was that every 2 years they had to move offices because they outgrew where they had been. One of the things that they did as a quick patch, because they were growing so rapidly and sort of in a sense throwing bodies at work, is they were promoting people so quickly because they felt they didn't have time to develop them to become managers and leaders. They didn't have time to do the search process to find in experienced leaders. So it's like, if you've been there for 6 months or a year, you've got an understanding of what the work's about. Congratulations, you're now a supervisor and you've got people reporting to you, but without any of the skills, right? So this is why I put the emphasis on capable people who actually know how to do the work that's expected of them. So I think those three things are very interdependent with each other: capable people, effective teams, and empowering culture. There's two other parts of the framework that I've seen. The one I call hybrid mastery, right? Because many organizations are kind of juggling this return to office, work from home thing. And so it's actually a skill, a capability also to nurture and develop. We can't assume that because we're 4 years into this pandemic / post-pandemic period, we've all worked out how to work in this distributed way. There are, again, skills, practices, and things like that, that teams and organizations actually need to practice and develop that help them work effectively. So again, that's a feature we want to pay attention to. And if you're a manager, how do you manage a workforce where you don't necessarily have the whole team together in one place on a regular basis? How do you manage individuals that might be working in a different city? So there's a lot of important capabilities that I think we're just beginning to understand and see the importance of. And then number five is adaptive leadership, right? So it's about the ability of leaders to not just focus on the work, getting the work done, but also being able to scan for what's going on around them, see what's coming up as changes that need attention. Or when you get hit by a major roadblock, not getting flummoxed and sort of disoriented, but finding ways to get around it or to get through it, right? So it's not just, I've got the plan, I'm going to follow the plan, but the plan's my guide. But when we meet reality, we'll do what we need to do to keep moving forward towards the destination we're working towards.
Well, that's the perfect quote by modern day philosopher and sportsman Mike Tyson. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
That's interesting, right.
You didn't immediately jump into, here's the tactic, here's the strategy, because the joke is we all run out onto the field with, here is our plan, that's our 55-page thing created by consultant XYZ, who's the smartest in the game. Everyone has that plan until you meet reality. And what you're saying is, that's fine. We're going to go in that direction, but we better have the right team in place.
Yeah.
The culture is key, and that will solve for a lot of the inevitable, I'm saying the word inevitable, issues that arise when you try to lift and shift what you have done and expect the same results in a different climate, geographic region, and everything that that entails.
Yeah. I also, you know, consider myself a recovering planner, right? I spent several years, if you want to believe this, I spent several years specializing in training and facilitating processes around logic frameworks, logic models, theory of change.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. I was doing this work in South Africa, where I lived for many years. And all the funders came in post-apartheid and they said, we want what they called logical frameworks for all the donor funding. And nobody knew what it was. It was a whole new thing. So, you know, I was working with some others. We provided a service around all of this. And so, you know, I'm very familiar with making really robust plans that are really about what we need to be doing for the next 3 years, 5 years. Here's how I look at that today. We want a plan that we know what we're working towards. That plan also should be based on a good understanding of where we are today. Right? We need to be realistic. What's going on? What are the sources of support? What might be points of resistance? Right? So we start from where we are. We have the direction in which we're moving with a sense of the destination. We've worked out some of the key points along the way. But we don't have, I would say, a detailed plan covering every single month of a funding cycle, because inevitably it's going to take longer to get started than we expected. Inevitably, somebody's going to leave the team and we're going to be short-staffed and maybe we'll be slowing down on some of the deliverables. So what I tend to think about is let's look at the whole planning period. Maybe we're setting some annual targets that we're working that we want to try and achieve. But we're actually doing the detailed planning on a rolling basis so that we've got a pretty good idea of what we should be doing over the next 6 months. We've got a fair amount of clarity on the 6 to 12 month window, and we're still working towards the major things. And that allows us to be continually reviewing and updating the plan to take account of actual progress and to take account of what's actually happening in our environment. It also promotes learning from experience, which I think is very important. We're not just implementing what was identified 2 or 3 years ago, but we're implementing based on the conditions that we're working in today.
There's a part of my heart that loves the logic model. Mm-hmm. It's pure, right? Inputs, outputs, outcomes. Do we agree on these things? Do we say, all right, if we do these things in this way, will we get to where we want to go? But for our process and the way we approach it is that that is step one, right, in our journey. But the key part is how do we then set that as key performance indicators that are measurable in your web analytics and other analytic places, mm-hmm. put those numbers in front of the leaders and be like, we all agreed those numbers matter. Remember the framework, but just remember. And then we said we would get to here. Why are we missing that?
Oh, boy. We could talk for hours about this.
Well, we're talking. We talked for 24 minutes. So we...
Perfect. So let's
tape's cheap.
Let's make it happen. So 26-year-old me would have agreed with you. The logic plan is pure, it's clean, it's rational, it's logical, to use a word, in a laboratory, which is what planning sessions often are. They're divorced from reality. They take place off-site in a kind of sterile environment. And as you said a little earlier, you know, no plan survives the first contact, you know, survives a punch in the face. So I think one of the mistakes of many plans is that they take place in this idealized environment and they're not sufficiently rooted in reality. There's one other thing that they also do is that they assume that they're working in a stable world. And I think when we are in this work of social change, we are by definition not in a stable world. There are many, many different actors that can have an influence on what's going on, whether it's different organizations, different peoples, changes in policy, changes in funding. There can be many unpredictables that can affect what we're working on. So a lot of the work that I do is I use an approach that acknowledges we're in a complex environment, a complex system, right? And so things like KPIs are well suited to a stable environment. They're not necessarily helpful in a more complex environment. But that doesn't mean there's no measuring. That doesn't mean we don't have goals and things we're working towards. But we can't be in this simplistic, mechanistic model of input, throughput, output, and therefore we'll be successful. Again, I come back to my gardening metaphor, not because I'm necessarily green thumbs myself, but because I think
I got the plan, I got the receipts behind me. I got a little gardener.
You're doing well. But gardens are untamable. They will do what they will do. We can influence them. We can shape them, but we actually can't determine exactly what's going to happen. And I think that's the sort of, maybe let's call it a humble orientation, maybe a learning orientation that I think we should have as leaders and as organizations. We have a good hypothesis about what's needed to bring about a change, coming from our experience, coming from our consultations and engagement with community, right? But we don't know if it's exactly going to work, right? Because that's the fallacy of the logic model. Just do these three things, bake for 45 minutes and boom, there you go. So we kind of come in with a hypothesis, we have a theory of change, let's call it that. But we come at it with humility and with curiosity. Like, this is our best thinking. So let's see what happens when we meet reality. How much of it holds up? Where do we need to adapt and innovate to keep moving forward despite setbacks and challenges and things like that? Because we know we're not going to get a perfect prediction of how to do it. But with that kind of engagement, feedback, learning, etc., we'll be able to kind of keep moving forward in the desired direction.
Yeah, and I think what you're pointing toward here, when we have kind of chiseled into stone our logic model, is the risk of rigidity. And your response here is in one of your points for the sustained change framework, which is adaptive leadership. Teams need targets. Mm-hmm. Make no mistake. There must be numbers. There must be accountability. However, the leader has the daunting task of adapting, of saying, you know what? All of the things we wrote and all the things we thought were built on a mountain of assumptions. Now that I see the, numbers playing out or the things in the field, we need to adjust to that. And so perhaps, going back to the parable and the sad parable of, hey, here's national expansion. Let's go buy up a whole bunch of spots and quickly staff up. Some of those metrics of, ruin might be, hey, how many cities do we have a presence in? As you mentioned before, what is our total headcount? Because there's can I just be honest? Sometimes an ego game with leaders being like, hey, how big is your organization? Oh, I got 55 people. Oh my gosh, you're doing so well. Like, according to what? According to the metric of how many people you pay per month?
Just like the old joke about somebody being asked how many people work for him. And the response is, well, about half of them are actually working.
That's a different problem.
I mean, for me, when I think about success, I look at it in terms of impact, right? Because I think this piece about focusing on quantitative growth, scaling, numbers of staff, size of budget, number of offices, those are the wrong things to assess whether or not we're actually making social change progress, right? So nonprofits are mission oriented, right? They're founded because they either see a great opportunity and they want to help more of something happen, or they're coming because they've seen difficulties and challenges and they want to kind of find ways to fill that gap, prevent something dire from continuing, right? So, we need to kind of look at how we approach these things, as in what's the difference that we're making, not just how big did we get in pursuing this mission? How many big names did we get on our board or for our charity event or something like that?
Yeah, it's a classic one. I guess when we approach the logic model, we do it from a certain perspective of a digital lens, and I'm curious to get your actual feedback on it, where at the core of what we're doing for organizations is trying to find relevant, efficient attention. We want attention of this target audience. That is an immutable truth, I feel like, pretty safe to go on. From there, I want a depth of engagement and a measure associated with that. And from there, I want a depth of commitment measurable by, did you give? Did you volunteer? Did you do the thing you said you would that changes the world in the way you want it? And if I assign measurements, I'm like, directionally, that's probably right for my design of metrics. I don't know how you land on that, though.
Measurements are tricky, right? So you spoke about, the value of targets and measurements as a way of accountability, right? They can serve that purpose. But there's also a saying, and I'm forgetting who it's attributed to, that something along the lines of what gets measured can be manipulated. I'm saying it wrong, right? But basically, people find ways to game measures. The other sort of risk with measures is, let's just say your target is 3,000 people to do something, right? When you meet the 3,000 target, you sit back because you've been successful. So, you know, the risk for me there is, in what ways was that target actually a limiting factor rather than a focusing factor? To what extent did you then set your aspiration of, well, let's get just 3,000 and we do everything to get 3,000 rather than actually finding interesting novel ways of doing things that could actually have a much broader reach, but our thinking, our mindset was limited because we had that quantifiable number in front of us.
I'm also torn though, because there's a tremendous amount of power in the, you know, we manage to what we measure, and I can influence behavior as a leader and as a designer of these systems, quite literally. And I can play a game with you and also those of you listening right now. I would attest that what I'm about to show you is the most influential dashboard in the world. And our knowledge of it is so intimate that right now, without looking, guess where the battery level on your phone is. Just throw out a guess. I know mine because it's plugged in. But right now, do that. Now, I want you to look at your phone and see where that measure is. Are you plus or minus 10 percentage points? Because that's amazing. Your intimate knowledge of that as a dashboard, because here's the measure. Do I have enough power to do the things I need? Mm-hmm. Now, the behavior part. When that gets low, I want you to like channel that emotion of it's at 5%. You're panicking. What is the behavior? So I really see power in how we design those targets, those measures, and those KPIs. Yet I hear you on this adaptive leadership, because you have to understand when someone's gaming the system. You know, look no farther than Wells Fargo and number of accounts opened to see the downside of what happens when you blindly give a, you know, target without a moral compass, for instance.
Right. So let me tell you a story, which is said to be true. Right. During the colonial period in the 19th century, when the English were overseeing or ruling or colonizing India, there was a big problem with poisonous snakes, vipers. So the British government came up with a scheme of paying people a couple of rupees for every dead viper that they brought in. That was such a successful program because there was always vipers being brought in and people collecting rupees. And it took several years before the colonial administration discovered there were actually viper farms feeding this incentive. So we've got to be careful with
targets. Hold on. That parable gets even funnier, because the next chapter in it is they get rid of the incentive and the viper farms are all, screw this, and they let go of all the vipers, thus compounding the problem.
Yes. We live in a complex world, right? Unpredictable actions of different actors that can have this impact. We thought we had sustained change because we got rid of that viper problem, but inadvertently we made it worse.
Yeah.
So, you know,
I probably have an over reliance, I'd say, on some of these metrics, but
I have to
build on a foundation somewhere, right?
Yes.
I have to plant stakes and own that as a leader, being
right.
Like, I made these assumptions. I planted the pylon so I could build a foundation, because otherwise I'm on sand and my building falls over.
Right. I'm with you. I agree on the importance of what I'm going to call here focus, right? So one version of it is I have a target I'm working towards. I got my dashboard. You use the example of your telephone battery. I've got my dashboard, so I know where I am. I know what kind of remedial measures I might need to take, et cetera, right? From a leader perspective, there's another way of looking at it. And I was preparing a social post recently that I'm sure will be published by the time this podcast goes out. As leaders, it's so easy to get distracted by what's going on around us on a daily basis. We get pulled back into the weeds, right? So I want to think about leadership focus or leadership mindfulness as, am I keeping front of mind the things that are most important to be doing? Right? Am I aware? Am I clear about what my priorities are? Am I clear on what's the work I need to be doing to pursue my priorities? And do I have a mechanism, a routine, a rhythm, to step back and return to those priorities on a regular basis so I can check whether or not I'm getting caught up in the weeds, I can check whether those priorities actually are still the right things given anything that might be changing. So whether it's a numerical quantitative target or strategic priorities that you're pursuing, yes, I think it's really important to have a focus that both gives us direction in which we're moving, but and also gives us a way to get feedback and assess our progress relative to that target or to the focus, and be able to deal with any changes that might require us to be adaptive.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, as we move to wrap up, I'm going to take us through some rapid fire questions. Please do your best. Keep it, you know, short, high,
sure,
tight.
Sure.
Because we got a few of these. All right, here we go. What is one tech tool or website that you or your organization has started using in the last year?
There's a great one. It's called Liberating Structures, right? Mm-hmm. The website is www.liberatingstructures.com. And what it is a toolkit of 34 different methods for working with change. There's a description and cases of each of the methods. And the beauty is that you can combine them with each other to organize a meeting, a workshop, a conference, a process. And I find myself going back the time and again to get resources from that. And in fact, I used a new one just yesterday with a client, coming back to this tool that says, hey, here's a way of doing something. That's great. Liberating Structures.
All right. What is one tech issue you're currently battling with?
So one of the things I do is I work with leaders in groups, communities of practice, learning communities, peer groups. And the tech issue that is in front of us is, how do we have some kind of a platform that's sticky enough for the members to kind of come in and share resources with each other, come in and check on what's the latest that's being shared, so that not everything is being run through email, or run simply through something like Slack. We've worked with a number of different platforms. Some of them are better than others, but I don't think we've been able to find the one platform that is an engaging, enticing place for leaders to spend time and support each other.
What is coming in the next year that has you the most excited?
So I might be a little bit provocative in terms of many of the topics you cover. So AI is here, right? It's going to do great things for us. But I think what's really exciting is how we are going to rediscover the importance and the power of people to deal with nuances and complexity that AI can't cover. So we're going to reappreciate the difference that people make that's really unique to people that we can't delegate out to machines.
What is coming? Talk about a mistake that you made earlier in your career that shapes the way you do things now.
Yeah, we spoke about it earlier in a way. It's assuming that the logic of the plan, the logic of the idea is going to win people over. You can just present the plan, show the rationality, and they'll support it. And I made that mistake several times. I might still make it sometimes, perhaps, but I'm trying to learn the importance of actually engaging people and building buy-in.
Do you believe that nonprofits can successfully go out of business?
Absolutely. Not that every one of them should, but there are some organizations who've done good work. And as an organization, as a social system, they're tired, they're worn out. And rather than trying to rejuvenate something that kind of, it's not necessarily past its purpose, but it's going to take more effort to rejuvenate it and to find new purpose and new meaning than to release the energy of people there into new things. I'll give you
what
a quick example of that. I worked for an organization several years ago in South Africa, and shortly after I left them, they went through a leadership transition, and that didn't work out as they wanted, and they were struggling to find a new leader to take the organization forward. And the board decided eventually, we're not finding the right leader. Let's close the organization. But we're doing it when we've got money in the bank so we can make a good exit for the staff. And we've got time to think about what do we do with all the assets of the organization and who do we want to distribute them to. So I thought that was actually very wise and clever. Not doing that out of crisis, but doing it intentionally.
What is something you think you should stop doing?
There's something I'd like to be able to stop doing, which is having to click unsubscribe to emails that come in saying, hey, I have a quick fix for you. And it's a problem that I don't even have. I wish those would just go away.
I don't think you're alone on that one. All right. Final question. How do people find you? How do people help you?
Great. So I'm on LinkedIn, Michael Randall. You'll find me there. I share regularly different posts and resources for people. My website is rcachangeadvisors.com, the company name Randall Consulting Associates. And come and have a chat. I work with leaders and teams as they're going through change, helping you deal with change with more calm and more confidence. So if you're looking for support as a leader, or you know people who need some of that support, I'd love to connect with you.
Well, thanks for your time. Thanks for sharing. And good luck this year.
Great. Thank you, George. Appreciate the work you and your team are doing.
This has been Using the Whole Whale podcast. If you want to keep learning more about these topics and others, head on over to wholewhale.com/university to keep learning with us. Thanks as always to GregThomasMusic.org for his tunes that underwrite our tracks. They're fantastic. Hope you're doing well, Greg. And just a reminder, subscribes really help us on any platform that you listen to us on. Please give a thought to click and subscribe, and maybe even a comment, because we like hearing from you.